From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
It's not often that a book about the dismal science is ranked number one on Amazon.com, but Tim Harford's The Undercover Economist reached the top of that list soon after it was published last spring. It's since been translated into 21 languages, and now it's being made available in a paperback edition by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Tim Harford to my show today. Hello.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Now, why do you call yourself an undercover economist? Are you doing sneaky work here?
Well, I'm just doing plain clothes work. Let's put it that way. I'm pounding the sidewalks and wandering into our favorite coffee chains and supermarkets and doing everyday stuff. And while I'm doing it, trying to understand what's going on, trying to discover the hidden patterns behind everyday life, which you see because you're an economist.
So other economists are working either in academia or working for major firms. Trying to predict the future of stocks and the like. And you're working for the Financial Times?
Yeah, trying to explain why you should never trust anybody who offers to tell you a good stock or, you know, whether the property market in New York's going to go up or down. Anyone who tries to tell you this, just run a mile.
Now, one of the articles you write in the Financial Times is called The Undercover Economist. What came first, the column or the book?
The book came first. I was writing a column for the FT called Dear Economist. It's like Dear Abby.
People
write in. They ask me to solve their personal problems. You know, how do they find their odd socks? Should they get a bikini wax? And I answer these problems with economics. And then Undercover Economist came later and is explaining the price of a cup of coffee, that sort of thing.
So you really can, as an economist, tell people how to find the lost socks? Because we have to talk after the show.
Yeah, no, I can help. Well, I can help you get around the fact that your socks will get lost.
That's just a fact of life.
Yeah, well, it's.
I have a whole pile of socks that I don't know where the other one went.
It's you need to take a leaf out of economic history. One of the great leaps forward in the Industrial Revolution was interchangeable parts. This is when a machine broke down. You could take out a cog and put a different cog in, take out a gear, put a different gear in, and it would still work. This is a huge revolution. You just need to apply the theory of interchangeable parts to your sock drawer. So buy 2 dozen pairs of identical black socks and all your sock problems will be over.
One question that you address early in your book is one that's been on many New Yorkers' minds. How can Starbucks charge $4.50 for a cup of coffee and still have a line of people waiting to buy it?
Well, the clever thing about what Starbucks does, like some other retailers, is they don't charge $4.50 for that cup of coffee to everybody. They're very, very good at offering different prices to different people. In the book, I call this price targeting. So you walk in the door, and what Starbucks would really like to know is how much you're willing to pay. If you're only willing to accept coffee for a dollar, they'll charge you a dollar. If you're willing to pay $10, they'll charge you $10. Now, of course, they can't do that because you don't go in wearing a baseball cap that tells them how much you're willing to pay. So instead, they offer you all these different products. And the choices you make, to squirt a little bit of syrup in for 50 cents, the size of coffee, or even there are some coffees they just don't advertise that are cheaper. These are ways of sorting out one customer from another.
I didn't know there are coffees that are not on the menus. You can ask for a short coffee.
You can ask for a short cappuccino. It used to be on the menu. It's 8 ounces. And this is, in my view, this is officially the best coffee in Starbucks. Now, there is a World Coffee Olympics called the World Barista Championships, and they say the official size of a perfect cappuccino should be about 8 ounces. So they have this thing. You ask for a short cappuccino. Any Starbucks in the world will serve it to you. It's cheaper. They've got a little button on their kiosk. They know all about it. They just don't tell you about it. And they don't tell you about it because they'd rather sell you something big.
Because they make more of a profit on the big?
They make more of a profit on the big, but there are some people who wouldn't shop there at all if they didn't know about the short. So this is a specific case of something economists call product sabotage. It's quite common to take a product that you don't make a lot of money on and actually make it a little bit less attractive to your customers so that not too many people buy it.
Well, most people simply charge more for the small size. If you go into the supermarket, you find that sometimes you can buy a box of soap that's almost twice the size as the smallest one for maybe 50 cents more.
Yeah, what I've found in supermarkets is that it's actually unpredictable. I always assumed, you know, the larger the size, the less you pay per ounce. Obviously, it's more, but, you know, it's less per ounce. But I found when I started looking, that wasn't true at all. You'd sometimes find the medium size was the cheapest. There was no pattern to it. And then I realized there was a pattern to the patternlessness, if you like. And the idea was that the more a supermarket mixes things up and makes you work to find out what is cheap and what isn't cheap, the more they're able to differentiate between a customer who's paying attention and a customer who isn't. Any predictable pattern in the pricing is something even a millionaire can shop cheaply if it's easy to do that. They want to mix things up to distinguish between the grandmother who checks every single label and the yuppie who's in a hurry who just grabs stuff off the shelf and doesn't check.
My guest is Tim Harford. His book, The Undercover Economist, exposing why the rich are rich, the poor are poor, and why you can never buy a decent used car. It is published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, didn't you find that high-end stores like Whole Foods usually charge the same prices for most products as the standard supermarket? Did price comparison with Safeway for identical items. So then why does a basket of groceries from Whole Foods seem to cost so much more? In fact, it does cost so much more.
Yeah, it does cost more because it's a different basket of groceries. See, this is a typical bit of undercover economics, and you just check the prices in Whole Foods and then march four blocks and check the prices in the local Safeway. Just have a look. Anybody can do this stuff. And what I found was if you're buying the same goods, you'll pay pretty much the same prices. In fact, I often found that the Whole Foods prices were slightly cheaper than the Safeway prices. But there's a reason for that. The goods I was looking at that you could get in both stores, you're talking about, say, organic onions. So basics, but organic basics. Organic butter, organic Tropicana orange juice.
The key word here is organic.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's not all organic, but or sparkling mineral water. It's another sort of high-quality product. And the distinction is if you go into Whole Foods and you buy organic Tropicana orange juice, you're at the bottom of the rung there. You buy sparkling water, sure. You know, people who shop at Whole Foods, they shower in sparkling water. Right? So these are just basics as far as the Whole Foods customer is concerned. As far as the Safeway customer is concerned, you're tipping the Safeway manager that actually you're a bit of a big spender as far as Safeway is concerned. So that explains why, if anything, the Safeway products were slightly more expensive. But of course, in Whole Foods, but not in Safeway, you're going to walk out with hand-dusted, gold-flecked $30 German chocolates and imported Belgian beers and all this great stuff. So it's not that Whole Foods is a more expensive shop. It's that Whole Foods encourages more expensive shopping.
And they don't have the cheap stuff, and there's also the impulse buy. But you also say that supermarkets deliberately sabotage some of their own products. They're private label brands.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great brand, Tesco's, my favorite brand supermarket in the UK, which has just come to the States, I think. Their value brand, it's unbelievable. I mean, it literally looks like a food drop from the World Food Program. I mean, this is really, it's just plain blue stamped on plain white. It's just monochrome, ugly. They all look the same. Doesn't matter whether it's orange juice or whether it's flour, whether it's sugar or whether it's bread. It all looks exactly the same in this box, you know, the value box. And the idea is not that they couldn't afford a good designer. The idea is that if you were going to buy nice bread or you're going to buy nice orange juice, why they don't want you to downgrade unless they really have to. It's not that they're trying to advertise how cheap the thing is. They're actively trying to discourage premium customers. They only want you to buy this stuff if you really are very price sensitive.
So does this apply all over the world? Because I was thinking while you were saying that of the way the French publish books, where they pretty much give you the same generic cover for everything from Tolstoy to Dan Brown. Is this something that is more likely to happen in England and the United States?
Well, I think there are always cultural, you know, specificities. Different cultures like to do things different ways. But I often find that even if there's a cultural reason for doing something, there's often some economics supporting it. I mean, here's an example. In Britain, because we don't have table service, there's an economic reason, by the way, we don't have table service. You know, labor's too expensive, taxes too high, that's why we don't have it. But we don't have table service, and so if you're in a pub, you go and get a round. You know, you buy a round for all of your friends. Now, the social anthropologists say that this is a gift-giving ritual, where you reinforce your bonds of friendship. And that is, I'm sure, is true. The Economist says you save on transaction costs. Why do you all have to queue for the bar, whereas when one person could queue and get 10 drinks for everybody? And the truth is actually both the cultural explanation and the economic explanation can be true at the same time. They reinforce each other.
You learned that IBM sabotages one of the premium printers it sells so it can charge less.
Yeah, actually, let's put the past tense on that. I don't know what they're doing.
They don't do it anymore?
I don't know what they're doing with the latest range. But some of the things I found about in the book and wrote about in the book, companies have stopped. And I don't know whether it's a coincidence or not, but you know, they find that maybe their customers don't want them to be doing this. But what IBM did, and I should say this is not unusual, what IBM did was they had a great printer, the LaserWriter, I seem to recall it was called, very, very popular amongst business users, an expensive printer, great market share, and they realized, you know, we could cut the price of this printer, sell it to home users, and we could still make money. And then some bright spark said, sure, but if you did that, then no, you wouldn't sell the very profitable business printers. So they thought, well, what do we do? And they realized the simplest way of doing that was just to put a chip into the printer to slow it down. Then you have two versions. You have the slow printer for the home user and you have the fast printer for the business user. But the slow printer actually costs more to produce than the fast printer. But it makes more sense than designing two printers from scratch. And that sounds incredible. But it's very common in the high-tech industry. And it's also probably better than the alternative, which is no cheap printer at all.
Because it's also a well-built printer. It's just slower.
I mean, if they were...
I want to find out where that chip is and just take it out.
Well, yeah. I mean, you find the same thing with digital cameras. You know, the high-end digital camera and the low-end digital camera is just the high-end digital camera. It's half the price. And it's got some of the features switched off. And, you know, if you know the right Russian hacker, you can get all the features switched on again. So this is common enough. But I'm not really trying in the book to expose corporate evil doing. I'm just trying to explain it, just trying to understand what's going on.
Well, can't we explain the Starbucks prices to some degree by the fact that they choose to be in high traffic areas, so their rents are higher than other coffee shops?
Well, that sounds really plausible, but I think it's the other way around. We are willing to pay, and we show this every day. We don't care what Starbucks rents are. If every Starbucks shop was there for free and was not paying any rent, you know, do you think they'd cut their prices because they felt sorry for us? Of course not. They charge what they can get away with. Any business does that. Nothing wrong with that. And we've shown we're willing to pay $4 or $5 for coffee if it's super convenient. Now, the reason the rents are so high is the flip side. If you have an absolutely prime location, you can sell $4, $5 coffee and people will buy it. And that means the prime location is very, very valuable, and that means that the landlords are going to make a lot of money out of companies like Starbucks.
Isn't this something that David Ricardo wrote about centuries ago?
Yeah, well, he didn't write about Starbucks, but he wrote about the forces of scarcity and what happens when you have. He was talking about agricultural land, different types of agricultural land, and then you know, as more farmers start to develop the land, more and more land becomes scarce. Now, instead of agricultural land, now we're talking about Manhattan street corner properties, and instead of growing crops, we're now cultivating Starbucks customers.
Does this explain why London rents are so high? I think they're among the highest in the world.
They are among the highest in the world. Similar to Manhattan rents, slightly higher these days, I think. There's a good reason behind that, which is that people are not allowed to build new houses in London. There's a green belt around London, severe restrictions on building new apartments, new houses for environmental reasons. And I'm sure there are good reasons, but there are unintended consequences. You've got a place where lots of people want to live, and you're not allowed to build a new house. You know, what do you think is going to happen to the price of housing?
Does this apply to other things, like certain professions which have only limited membership?
Well, I'm always a little bit suspicious when I see all these sort of the qualification rules to be members of certain professions, you know, lawyers, doctors. And I guess you can sympathize. You want to know that your doctor is super well qualified. Although it's interesting that it's actually illegal to accept medical advice from someone who isn't qualified. You know, you might think there'd be some gray areas. But then when you start to realize that hairdressers need to be licensed or manicurists, you start to wonder what the purpose of these licenses really are. And one of the things that they achieve is to make it more difficult to enter these professions. And that means you make more money because you've generated artificial scarcity in the same way that the green belt around London has generated a scarcity of houses.
My guest is Tim Harford. His book, The Undercover Economist, Exposing Why the Rich Are Rich, the Poor Are Poor, and Why You Can Never Buy a Decent Used Car. It is now available in paperback from Random House. I mentioned earlier that it was from Oxford. That was the hardcover. Now we get the paperback from Random House. And we continue our conversation right after this. We're back with Tim Harford, H-A-R-F-O-R-D. His book, The Undercover Economist, Exposing Why the Rich Are Rich, the Poor Are Poor, and Why You Can Never Buy a Decent Used Car. It is now available in paperback from Random House. You've raised some eyebrows with your claim here that sweatshops in third world countries are necessary, perhaps even desirable. Don't sweatshops exploit people who have few alternatives?
Yeah, they do. They do. I mean, desirable? They're a step on the road to something better. I think if they weren't a step on the road to something better, I'd be very concerned about them. But you need to see what's going on with the sweatshop industry. You have countries like China where you have a lot of sweatshops. You have a lot of people working in very dangerous, very difficult conditions, very poorly paid, very long hours. I would never want to work anything like those conditions. But already you see in China, wages are rising. People thought it could never happen. You have a billion workers, but already wages are rising in China. Foreign companies that are investing in China are having to pay higher wages because otherwise they lose staff. They get staff turnover. I mean, this is not slavery. Staff quit. People go off and set up their own businesses because they don't want to work like that. And you look at the countries which have had sweatshops in the past: South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, America, Great Britain. I mean, we've all been through this stage of development. It would be great if it didn't have to happen. And then finally, you look at Africa. No sweatshops in Africa. No one's interested. This is a continent that's totally cut off from globalization. And the situation in Africa is far, far worse than the situation in China. So now I'm not sanguine about it. I'm not happy about it. But I don't think this is something that we can just legislate our way out of.
So African countries should invite Nike to start building sweatshops there?
I don't think Nike's interested at all. That's the
thing. Why wouldn't they be? After all, they're interested in Central America. They're interested in Southeast Asia.
But the institutions in Africa, the infrastructure, how difficult it is to operate, the lack of respect for the rule of law in many African countries. I mean, we're talking about this continent. It's full of different countries. The situation's different everywhere. The situation is that I don't think Nike would want to operate in Africa even if the wages were zero, even if people were paid literally nothing. The cost of doing business would be so high. And that's something that I can only hope African leaders are able to sort out, because that's when Africa will finally start to grow, as China and India have done.
You went to Cameroon to look into this?
Yeah. I mean,
Why Cameroon rather than Nigeria, let's say?
Rather than Nigeria. Well, I've been to Nigeria too, but I write about Cameroon in the book. It's a place I'm rather fond of, actually. Was engaged to my wife in Cameroon. But I think the story of Cameroon is very, very sad. This is a country which used to be substantially richer than China. Substantially, in the 70s, Cameroon was twice as rich as China. This is a country that's almost totally cut off from the world. It's not Burma or North Korea, but tariffs are so high. The idea is to protect domestic industry from competition, right? But there is no domestic industry because nobody can ship anything into the country. People are desperately, desperately poor. There's a lot of corruption. And you want to set up a business in Cameroon. First, you have to hand over what would be the equivalent in the US of, say, $20,000, just as a fee for setting up a legal business. So guess what? Nobody sets up a legal business. I mean, it's a terrible situation.
Well, how does this fit in with standard economics, free market economy? You mentioned globalization in a positive way. There are many people, including Joseph Stiglitz, who's another economist, who see it as a rather mixed blessing these days.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Stiglitz is not just another economist. He's a Nobel Prize winner. Everything...
Well, I only speak to a few, and he's one of the ones
He's amazing. Joe's amazing. That said, people like Stiglitz, and there are a small number of people like Stiglitz, they get a lot of attention, partly because they're smart, and partly because their views are unusual. And I would agree with Stiglitz that globalization is a mixed blessing, but I think it's a blessing nonetheless. It's something that we need to try to manage. But I don't think even economists that we think of as being rather heterodox, rather left wing, like Krugman, Stiglitz, they're not arguing for trade barriers to come up. They're not arguing for poor countries to turn their backs on globalization.
Well, you live in England, where there's universal health care. But in the United States, our health care is provided largely through the free market. It doesn't seem to be doing very well.
It's not doing very well at all. I agree. It's not really provided through the free market, though. I mean, the first fact that I found fascinating researching my book is that the U.S. government spends more per person on health care than the U.K. government. And somehow in the UK, the government is able, I mean, the healthcare is not brilliant, but it's free, it's universal, everybody gets coverage, everyone gets treatment, life expectancy is the same as in the US, must be doing something right. Where's the US government spending all this money on? You know, various tax breaks and inefficiencies and open-ended stuff. But I don't think we do have a properly operating free market for healthcare in the US, because all healthcare is effectively provided through insurance companies. So you're always dealing through an intermediary. Now, I don't want to pretend that this is an easy problem to solve. I think there are easy problems to solve in economics, and this is not one of them. But what I would like to see is people having more insurance for really big risks. I think everybody in America should be insured for expensive medical procedures. But I think everyone in America and in Europe as well should have less insurance for the little risks. I mean, we're insured for our annual medical checkup. That doesn't make any sense. That's like, you know, it's like your auto insurance covering you for a change of tires or for filling up with gas. That doesn't make any sense, and we pay for it in the end through our premiums.
What about pharmaceuticals? They're so much more expensive here than they are in the rest of the world, too.
Yeah, we'd like to thank you for that, actually, because Americans are subsidizing the rest of the world by providing this amazing market for pharmaceuticals, stimulating pharmaceutical research, and then the rest of the world is free riding on it. So, the rest of the world better hope you don't change the system, but we're all benefiting from it. Thanks a lot.
Does the science of economics deserve the reputation it's earned for being rather tedious, dominated by numbers, and also unreliable?
I think it deserves the reputations because of the way that economists have presented it. We get a reputation for numbers because that's what you see every day in the papers, because that makes easy news reporting. But I don't think economics really is about the numbers. Economics is about people. It's about the decisions we make, the trade-offs we face, the constraints we face. I mean, this is serious stuff. Unreliability? Absolutely. I mean, it does deserve a reputation for unreliability. And, you know, there's a reason for that. The economy is incredibly complicated. I mean, it's really, really hard. I don't want to be making excuses for economics, but you just think of a simple product like a cup of coffee, the amazing team effort that went into that, the beans, the ceramics, the electricity, the espresso machine, everything that went into that, even a cup of coffee, incredibly complicated product.
And obviously, when you're predicting the future of the stock market. There's no way you can know whether somebody you never heard of is developing an iPod, or you know, the equivalent of an iPod that's just going to change everything in a certain sector.
Well, the stock market's even worse because predictions of the stock market are actually self-defeating. I mean, it's a really simple way to understand this. It's like when you're queuing up in the supermarket, you're trying to find the shortest line at the supermarket. You know, you stand there, you're trying to pick the shortest line, and you see one over at till number 12, you're thinking, hey, yeah, that line looks pretty short. But then before you've got there, someone else has seen that, and they've got in the line. It's not the shortest line anymore.
Well, the person is arguing with the clerk.
Yeah, or the unexpected happens. But the point is, whatever looks like the shortest line, if it's obviously the shortest line, people are going to get in it, and it's not the shortest line anymore. And the same is true of shares of property. If a share is obviously cheap, it isn't going to be very cheap for long.
Several reviewers suggested that your book be required reading in Economics 101 classes. Do you know whether any schools have adopted it?
I've heard of a couple. I'm sure schools are more likely to adopt it now the paperback's out. You know, these guys aren't stupid. Students don't want to pay for hardback editions.
But didn't you once teach economics to adults in Ireland?
Yeah, I taught a little in Oxford, and I also taught in University College Cork. And I just heard back from my old colleagues at University College Cork that they've started an optional course based on the book, which is, you know, it's a lovely thing to hear.
You also studied philosophy. Why philosophy? Are philosophy and economics connected in any way?
I think they are. I mean, I originally studied philosophy and the economics came by accident. The philosophy department told me, you know, the economics department say that your strengths lie in economics, and we agree. So the philosophy department basically booted me out. But absolutely, the two disciplines are connected. Adam Smith, maybe the most famous economist in the world, first wrote a great book of moral philosophy. They're both intimately connected with questions of ethics and how we behave. So, yeah, they're connected for sure.
Well, in the book, you suggest that even though a philosophy degree doesn't prepare a student for a specific career, having one on one's resume at least lets an employer know that you're not lazy or dumb.
Yeah, no, this is fun. This is an idea from Michael Spence, who's another Nobel Prize winner. The idea is that some of the degrees that you do, it's really hard to see why employers value them. It's really hard to see what it is that you could possibly be learning. And the idea is, well, you're not really learning anything. You're just proving. You're just proving you can work hard, you can do difficult stuff. That's something that's valuable in the world. And, of course, the guy who came up with it, his first degree was in philosophy.
Can we address some of the things in your subtitle, why the rich are rich, the poor are poor, and why you can never buy a decent used car?
Sure. Which one do you want to start with?
Well, with the beginning. Why the rich rich and the poor poor?
I think the simplest answer is that in a country like America, if you want to be rich, the easiest way to get rich, not the only way, but the easiest way to get rich is to find something that people want and work out a way to give it to them. You get rich by creating wealth.
I thought the easiest way was to be born rich. And somebody complained that too many rich people are born, I don't know if you know, yeah, you must understand baseball, you lived here, born on third base and think that they earn the way over there because they're closer to home than the rest of the people.
I certainly think it's true that if your parents are rich, you start in an incredibly privileged position. But that's not the same thing as meaning the person who's born rich is just rich because he's always rich. I mean, these people who are born into the privileged positions, they get great contacts, they get great degrees, they get exposure to the best schools, and they become extremely productive people. Now, I agree, that's the result of unequal access, but it's not the same as what would happen in, say, a poor country where you're born rich, and you're born rich because your dad's a crook, and then he can make you a crook as well. In a country like Cameroon, the easiest way to be rich, in fact, pretty much the only way to be rich, is to steal, usually as a member of the government. And it's not surprising if people who want to be rich turn to theft that the country's going to be poor.
And you say never buy a decent used car? Aren't
okay.
A few available?
Give me some poetic license here. But yeah, I mean, what's really going on there is, you know, if you've got a great used car, you want to hang on to it. You don't want to sell it. And there's a reason you don't want to sell it. I think we take it for granted, actually. We don't think of it. But the reason you don't want to sell it is because you know you can't get a fair price for it, because you can't prove that it's a great car. But it doesn't just apply to cars. I mean, I think most interesting example is this applies to jobs. I mean, you're in the same position when you're applying for a job as someone trying to sell a great used car. You're trying to prove that you're a great candidate. not easy to do.
After you completed the book, you helped create and star in a British TV series called Trust Me, I'm an Economist.
Which, incidentally, you should never do. Never trust an economist. If you see the TV series, you'll understand why.
Is it a comedy show?
There are a few laughs in it. I mean, I take a guy speed dating and give him economic advice to get a date. And let's just say he crashes and burns.
And BBC America is not showing this, unfortunately.
Well, I hope they will, but not yet. It only ran a few months back, so we'll see. Even The Office took time to come over.
And you have a new book, I understand, The Logic of Life?
I'm working on that at the moment. It's going to be published in the spring of next year. It's the economics of teenage pregnancy, crime, racism, inner city violence, and why wives are smarter than their husbands.
Tim Harford will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store in the Citicorp building, on 54th Street and 3rd Avenue. And his book is The Undercover Economist, Exposing Why the Rich Are Rich, the Poor Are Poor, and Why You Can Never Buy a Decent Used Car, available now in paperback from Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much. Been great.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.